Morning, everyone. Welcome to Senate Finance. It is, what day is today? 4th, February 4th. It's about 5 after 9, and present at the table are Senator Machicki, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Co-Chairman McKinnon, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Olson, and myself, Senator Kelly. And today we're just going to have a presentation on state debt and the credit rating with Devin Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell, if you'd like to come up, go ahead. And any comments or questions to get us started off from the committee? Hearing none, Mr. Mitchell, you have the floor.
Thank you. For the record, Devin Mitchell, I'm the state's debt manager. First, thanks for the opportunity to address the committee. Obviously, ask questions at any point throughout the presentation. There are a couple of typos in the presentation. We've thrown it together in kind of a hurry because of just other pressures. We've, in my office, priced three bond issues in the last month for about $300 million, and so we've had other things going on. So a technical question, should I use this computer to advance slides?
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, how long do you think your presentation is?
I can make it whatever you want. Are we done?
Well, I like the way I like the way we did it yesterday, where we would have you go until there was a natural break point, and then we'll stop, and then people can ask questions. So if the committee members could hold their questions until appropriate times, I'd appreciate it. Go ahead, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you. So this first slide is just intended to give kind of an overview of the process that we go through when the state issues debt. So first of all, any obligation of the state of Alaska has to be approved by the legislature. Once obligations are there's an authority given by the legislature, then the administration implements that. To the extent it's allowed by law, the exception would be general obligation bonds, where then it has to also be approved by voters. And then the administration would implement the issuance of that authority. In some instances, there's public corporations that are given authority to issue debt, or other political subdivisions of the state that have been given authority to issue debt that the state supports. That process is static.
Mr. Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
Senator Dunleavy would like to ask you a question.
Just a quick one on the first line. It's authorized by the legislature, and is all of this debt, once it's authorized, let's say it's authorized in 06 or 05 or 04, is it considered open-ended, or does it come in different types of authorizations with a sunset or not? In other words, do we know how many acts have taken place by the legislature that have left the ability to bond open, like pension obligation bonds, for example?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we addressed that in the presentation, but generally, unless there was a termination date or a sunset date in an authorization, it is in effect until it's implemented.
So theoretically, we could have concurrent authorizations happening right now?
Yes.
And corporations also given authorization.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll go over that.
Yeah. Generally. As far as the state debt goes, all of that has to be approved by the state bond committee. So the state bond committee approves a resolution at a public meeting of the committee. The resolution will determine the structure of the debt, which will generally be based on the financial goals of the transaction, the state's fiscal position at the time. We put together various documents that are required for the issuance of the obligation, including what's called a preliminary official statement, which is a disclosure document wherein which we must describe to potential interested investors that information which we believe they would want to know. And so you have to be very careful in what you put in that document so that you have properly informed potential investors, as that's something the Securities and Exchange Commission is very interested in you doing adequately. bonds are sold, then we have a couple of different ways we can do that, competitive or negotiated. Proceeds are put in the bank and then spent on the projects. We have worked pretty hard within the management of the State Bond Committee and its undertaking to match up the project expenditures, so the construction side and the financing side. We hadn't issued GO bonds for quite a while when we sold in 2003. Our last sale before that was about 1987. So at the governor of the time's direction, we wound up selling an entire authorization of $460 million for transportation bonds, GO bonds, in 2003, and we didn't wind up spending all that money until 2013, which is not a good match between your borrowing and your actual projects on the ground. And so for example, the 2012 Transportation Act tried to do a much better job of getting money just in time to satisfy the construction need. The school debt reimbursement program is one of, is the largest single obligation of the state when it comes to debt, and that's a program administered by the Department of Education and Early Development. There's some requirements in order to participate in that program, including that the bonds must be general obligations of the local community. They have to be at least 10 years, and they have to be level debt service, and that's because we want you have a program that's designed to spread payments out over time rather than have a lump sum payment up front. If you wanted a lump sum payment, they were going to amortize bonds in 1 year, well, you just would have given them a grant rather than had them participate in this program. So it spreads payments out and allows future dollars to pay for projects today, which I didn't really include it in this presentation as a slide, but I know that there's sometimes discussion about whether or not debt's a good idea generally, and there's different philosophies about that, and certainly in my personal life I tend to avoid debt where I can, but I do have a home mortgage and have borrowed for larger purchases at different times. But at the state level it's a little bit different, or at the community level I should say, it's a little bit different. In the instance where you're paying taxes for a project, and there's this concept of I'm paying taxes so that I have something, where if a community said, well, I know your road's got a lot of potholes in it, we're going to tax you to put money in the bank so we can fix that in the future. Well, you might pay taxes for 10 years to put the money in the bank to fix the road, and then you moved away, and the road is fixed, but you didn't get the benefit of it. Where if you said, hey, that road needs to be fixed, it's in the public's interest to fix that road, we could borrow the money, and then we will be taxing you to pay for it over the next 10 years, but you'll actually get the benefit of a smooth road, then there's this concept of you as the user of the road paying for it, which is kind of one of the primary reasons I think people consider using debt. And the other reason is more of the concept that we can borrow tax exempt, we can invest taxable. So to the extent we in Alaska are fortunate enough to have large reserves, those being invested in the manner that we have them invested affords us an opportunity to earn more than we're going to pay in interest rates on money we borrow. But you have to be able to do any borrowing in a very judicious fashion, meaning that you're not borrowing for niceties, but you're borrowing for necessities. There's a scale of essentiality that you have for projects, and it can't be something that's low on the essentiality scale. It has to be something that's high on the essentiality scale if you want to conform to a best practice for the use of debt. Let's see. Whoops. So this slide is one of the slides that has a typo in it.
Before you go, Mr. Mitchell, questions, comments from the committee? Senator McKinnon.
I'll yield to, I'll wait, Senator Bishop.
Senator Bishop, go ahead.
Devin, you said a couple of things, and I just wanted to bring it out to the body's attention. I talked a little bit about this the other night at a meeting with another group, but you talked about the GO bond sale in early 2000s, right? And we remember we were in tough times, right? Mm. And small capital budgets and this 400 $1 million bonding was to go out and get money on the street to help us smooth that downturn in the price of oil back then. But my point being, and you brought it up, and I really keyed in on it, was even though they were executed in 04, that money didn't start hitting the streets until 08. And to me, that should be a signal here. I mean, provided some point in time we would go down this road again, I would be one that would want to make darn sure that contracts are project ready, bid ready, to take advantage of what we're trying to do. Because, you know, to sell bonds and then 4 years down the road the money hits the streets, I think it kind of defeats the purpose. No dig on you, it's just an observation from my point. And on your analogy, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Right ahead.
And on your analogy of essential bonding, and you used the road scenario. I think it's important that, you know, that we keep our roads maintained, because, you know, you talked about somebody paying and then leaving. Well, if we have to keep our assets up, or your property values are going to drop as homeowners and individual property owners, you know. And so just it's just more of a philosophical discussion on my points.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay. Senator McKinney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, who is on Alaska State Bond Committee?
Through the chair, it's a committee established by statute, and so it's the commissioners of the Department of Revenue, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Administration, or their designees. So right now we have designees, three deputy commissioners are on the committee as the commissioners' designees.
Okay, so the administration is controlling the issue, basically, on how we move forward with debt. I think that we're going to get there later, but on school debt specifically, we suspended the program in hopes to not incur additional debt from that one aspect of debt. How much in bonds have already been let and approved by the Department of Education that haven't been let under that particular banner, just the school bond? I have page 5 of 55 on the debt report. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the reimbursable to municipalities of $895 million, it looks like. But how much is still outstanding of just the school debt?
Through the chair, it's about $60-65 million
more.
That was authorized prior to the deadline of January 1st, 2015. Yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
And then, so that's good to know that we've started to control that that cost to the state of Alaska, so that we have a fixed number. But you spoke to all the other agencies inside the state, public corporations, and other political subdivisions that can bring to bear debt onto the state. And some of that affects us differently. If it's a revenue bond, the revenues have to back the bond. But under the GO portion, as I understand it, in the debt affordability analysis January 2016, am I right to assume that under general obligations alone that we have unissued debt of $271 million that still could hit our balance sheets?
Through the chair, yes.
And is there other debt that is scheduled to hit our balance sheets that would impact our credit rating? If it's later, I'll just hold, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we have this slide.
Okay, we'll just stand by and go through to get to that point. Any other questions or comments? Go ahead, Mr. Mitchell.
So this is really just targeted debt. Not if you looked at the state's Alaska public debt book, there's more debt than just this. This is what the state pays directly out of the general fund. And so this is intended to be outstanding at June 30, 2015, and the errors are the Kinnick Arm Crossing and POBs. Those are both zeros. There's no balances outstanding for either one of those projects at this point, or at June 30, 2015. General obligation debt, about $750 million. That's average annual debt service of $60 million a year right now. We do have additional authorization that we are going to be implementing in the coming years to continue to fund projects in the 2012 Transportation Act that will result in that $60 million hanging in there longer than it otherwise would if we didn't issue any new debt. And we drill down further into that on the next slide. The subject to appropriation obligations, certificates of participation, or lease revenue bonds, we have $310.6 million outstanding. That's primarily Goose Creek is the largest piece of that, Goose Creek Correctional Facility, and then the ANTHC Residential Housing Facility and the Virology Lab. And those issues mature, between 2017, actually, and 2033. And then the Kinnick Arm Crossing, like I said, is zero, but it's I threw it in here because it comes up in the next table that's very similar to this, authorized but unissued. The POB bonds, same story. School debt reimbursement, outstanding. This is just the state share, so there's more debt than this that's actually outstanding at the municipal level, but the state participates. On some projects, there's a sliding scale, and I don't understand it necessarily. I just hear what DEED says and follow their direction. But like if you're building a pool, maybe you only get 20-25% reimbursement from the state because it's a community pool and the school only uses it for some portion of the time. But you can get as much as 70% reimbursement under the authorization that ended on January 1st, 2015. And then there was a one-time bill back in 2004, House Bill 528 that authorized some other reimbursements of capital projects, so that it includes some energy projects where debt was already outstanding and then some transportation projects, and that's about $35.8 million outstanding at this point, with a final maturity projected in 2031.
Could we back up? Go ahead.
Okay. And by Mr. Mitchell, Senator Machicki, and then Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, you talked about on the school debt reimbursement, the state share. Do you have any idea what the municipal share of that?
I could tell you in a second.
Just take a brief of these. Go ahead. Record, Mr. Mitchell, would you restate Senator Machicki's question as you understand it and then answer?
So to reiterate the portion or the total debt that's outstanding that the state's share of which is $895.4 million related to school construction in the state, and the total outstanding is $1.3 billion. And so the community share is about $400
million.
Okay. Senator Machicki?
What if things are a little tougher than usual in the state here, if there were a risk of insolvency with any of those municipalities, what is the potential increased risk to the state of that $400 million?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, there's going to be a variety of potential level of additional support that could be wrung out of the local communities. Some communities it would be so that there's been a proration, of the support for the program in the past, back in the early 90s. The program used to fund 100% of school construction, so it was the program's kind of been modified to build in or bake in that that community participation. But there are definitely communities. If you made it zero, every community would have a very, very difficult time. Anchorage is the largest participant in the program by far. I can't recall exactly what it is, but it's near half of the authorization is Anchorage, and they would have a hard time coming up with that additional funding. And that rolls down to every community at their proportional level. I guess one of the communities that comes to mind with me is, you know, Dillingham has a $10 million school size geo bond issue outstanding that the state pays 70% of, and for a community like that to have to pick up that additional debt service would be a heavy lift.
Last
final. Senator Machicki?
So if the state is ultimately has ultimate obligation for those bonds, though, is that correct? If for some reason municipality could not perform, is the state on the hook for the remainder of what the municipality couldn't afford to cover?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, no. It's a general obligation issuance of the municipality. The state has an agreement wherein it funds a portion of the debt service, but there's no additional commitment. There's a deal that's been struck with the municipalities for the funding of schools, and there would likely be I don't know how all of that would shake out because of the constitutional requirement, the state fund education, and the different issues that would come out of the woodwork if there were a zeroing out of that program. But it isn't a state obligation when it comes right down to it.
Thank you.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where to start? With Anchorage carrying 50% of the school debt that we're carrying, it makes a difference whether they are carrying that debt at a higher interest rate than is currently available or not. And under the previous administration, both here at the state and at the municipal level, it came to my attention that Anchorage was carrying a higher percentage debt load, and it's my understanding that we approached Anchorage to refinance their debt so that our debt service would be lower. That basically, if you keep a high interest loan and don't go through the refinancing, if the state's picking up 70% of it, there's less burden. And for whatever reason, the previous administration in the city of Anchorage decided not to refinance their debt. And so I'm wondering if the administration is looking at that. If a city that we're currently picking up the 70% of the cost of construction for them, and they are unwilling to refinance if we think there's cost savings from a state perspective, and they disagree for whatever reason, isn't there a way that we can reduce the payments that we pay them on? Are you proposing a state statute that would work in the state's best interest in this particular relationship, where we're picking up debt and someone's carrying debt at a higher percentage rate that's currently available on the market? And I know there's a delta and that moves, and there's a cost for local communities to refinance debt. But there's a cost to the state of Alaska in our repayment of that 70% when they maintain higher rates on their higher interest rates payments on their debt. Did everybody follow that? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. It's complex, but what it means is,
for the record, I did not, so if you could repeat it.
So let me just say it like a house. If I owned a house,
right,
in a McKinnon, and I was paying 10% interest, and the Fed rate was currently what it is right now, say 3 to 5%, and the state of Alaska was picking up 70% of my 10% rate, there would be cost savings to the state if I went and refinanced. There's also cost to me. So I may not have the capital. I may be working my job really hard and can't refinance because I don't have, you know, the $3,000 in closing costs to go refinance my debt. But the state of Alaska is giving me a percentage of my payment every time. I'm saying that, as I understand it, there's an issue like that on Anchorage's school debt, that while the state refinanced our debt for a lower interest rate, the city of Anchorage, who is 50% of our total debt capacity, at least on some bonds, there are reasons why they would not do that. I want to make that very clear. But
as someone who's sworn an obligation to the state of Alaska to protect our finances, I'm just wondering if the administration is bringing forward a package that would somehow structure if there's lower debt available and the reason it is justified for us to pay less on that debt, and we have a partner that we want to support but is refusing to refinance for whatever reason that may be justified, should we keep paying the 70% or should we modify our payment down to how we would loan? Should there be compensation to the rest of the state for someone else carrying higher interest rates on their loans?
So, Mr. Mitchell, the question isn't should we do that, but is what she stated accurate, that we're carrying loans that you could refinance at a lower rate, they're not being refinanced, we are not receiving the savings from that because for whatever reason they're not refinancing?
Mr. Chair, so I am aware of the discussions we had in the last administration about the school debt reimbursement program, and there were some strategies going on within the municipality of Anchorage. There, when you issue bonds, there's typically a 10-year par call. So at the 10th year, you can refinance the next, if it was a 20-year issue, 10 years of the loan. Up until that 10th year, you can't refinance any of the loan unless you use a technique that's called an advance refunding, which you can do once under the tax code during the life of the bond issue. In an advance refunding, you borrow money today, you put it into an escrow account where it pays the interest expense on the callable bonds that would maybe are 6 years away from today, and at the sixth year when the bonds become callable, it pays the call on those bonds and retires them. That's called a defeasement, and it allows you to take those bonds off your balance sheet. The bonds that you might issue to replace them, the advance refunding bonds, then become the bonds that you're paying debt service on. At that time, when we discussed this, Anchorage was following a strategy of avoiding using that advance refunding technique because of their desire to wait to the call date. Their rationale was that the escrow that was being funded was going to earn a rate that was less than the coupon rate on the bonds that were going to be optionally redeemed, meaning that if there was $100 that were going to be called, you can't just put $100 into that escrow account because the reinvestment of that escrow account is going to be at a lower rate than the coupon rate on the bonds. So you have to put maybe $120 in there. That's called negative arbitrage. We talk about positive arbitrage in other situations. This is negative arbitrage. So that negative arbitrage is quantifiable. You can say, okay, that results in, you know, $20 that I've got to pay that I could have saved if I was refinancing my bonds currently today with the same interest rate environment. So they were making a bet that interest rates are going to stay low. Senator McKinnon's point is that we have strategies where we use advance refundings based on savings thresholds, and those at the time weren't being followed by Anchorage. Should there's no plan that I'm aware of within the administration to modify that. I think what I would hope personally is if or when the school debt reimbursement program is going to be back before the legislature for a potential reauthorization, that maybe we discuss ways of revamping the program at that point in time so that moving forward we're not changing a deal after we've made it. We're making a new deal. And I know one of the things we talked about previously was maybe have the state just participate with a level of funding and then the local community can bond for whatever their piece is, and we don't care at that point. You know, if we say we'll fund 70% of the project, we'll fund 70% of the project. We'll issue bonds. At the state level, we're going to get a better deal than anybody at the state level. And then they can go out and borrow 20% or 30% or 40% or whatever it is, pay cash for it. We don't care. And that gives, in some ways, more flexibility to the local communities, gives us better control of our debt. And so anyways, that's maybe not what you were hoping for the answer.
Senator Bishop.
On that point, then we're only carrying 70% on our balance sheet, and their 30 or 25% never shows on our balance sheet.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm switching topics now on your asterisk, on your general obligation on slide number 2. It does not include BAN, which is bond anticipation notes. And my office and yours, with the Department of Revenue, has exchanged some emails because I came across an email that notified the legislature that the administration was getting ready to move forward, I believe, with issuing debt of 271. What is the number that is consideration for next week or this week?
Through the chair, the state has a $155 million bond anticipation note that matures on March 18th of this year. We're looking at issuing $151 plus or minus a million of GO bonds in early March to refinance that bond anticipation note. So that'll be the next GO bond sale of the state.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and so it's confusing to me. I don't work in debt all of the time, and I know that we can use bond anticipation notes in one-year time periods and that we have a cash call coming due, basically. Is that correct, Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
And I'm not sure what that cash call is for. I believe it's for the transportation package or that and a combination of previous GO bonds that have projects that we're trying to get ready to participate with local communities. Can you tell me why we've used one-year bonds when we had such assets in our savings accounts?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we've been using bonds because they were authorized by the legislature and the voters back in 2012. And that's the funding source for that $453.2 million worth of projects, transportation projects around the state. And we've been, since 2013, issuing bond anticipation notes annually, in part because of my earlier discussion about what we had happen back in 2003. We had a lot of optimism again about how quickly money was going to get spent. We had estimates of a couple hundred million being spent in the first 18 months. We issued $150 million and cumulative in 2013, then we refinanced that in 2014, refinanced it in 2015. Cumulatively through those three issues, we funded about $180 million worth of project cost. And there hasn't been the level of spending that was projected initially. And so at this point, we've reached a time frame where we're looking at our bond anticipation note exceeding the debt management policies for what we would want to have as a variable rate position, given the projections for spending in the coming 12 months and the historical spending to date. And so we're talking about fixing out this $151 million. And then having the potential for a follow-on bond anticipation note as cash flow requires sometime in the calendar year.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator McKinnon.
So as we move to take short-term debt that we were using for cash flow on previous bond projects, do we have a $151 million cash flow for bonds? Because as I understand it, and this goes to what Senator Bishop said, let's make sure the project's ready to go. And what we did in some of those bond packages was only fund design. And so if you're only funding design, aren't we I just question the utilization of debt in this way if some of those projects are never going to come to fruition. And I wonder if we did an analysis of the money that we're paying in interest for projects that aren't going forward by either bond anticipation notes or GO bonds, what that looks like. Because I know that we're trying to be prepared because we have an obligation to those projects if they come to us and ask for the money. But it seems like we're financing debt, and now we're taking what we've done short term and somehow spanning it over 30 years, and we don't even know if we have the project yet. So help me understand specifically what's in the 151 that we're putting out there that's a real project that's going forward. And I know there are some.
Mr. Mitchell, can you stand by just a moment over the call, please? Back on the record, seems that all too often we hear the sirens coming to this building and we find out that someone's having a medical issue. Yeah, brief at ease. A staffer in Rep. Newman's office, Daryl, is having a medical problem. I just want to take a moment to pray for him, anybody that wants to. I'll lead us in a quick prayer, and if you agree with me, we'll just say amen at the end. Heavenly Father, we ask that you bless Daryl, that you protect him, that you favor him as he goes through whatever this medical issue is. We ask that you give inspiration to the people that are treating him, and that he comes back to us in good shape. And we say this in the name of Yeshua, Jesus of Nazareth. Amen. Okay, Mr. Mitchell.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon. So the $151 million is to refinance the 2015 A-band and the prior bond anticipation notes bands. And the project's expenditures that have been made to date are approximately $130 million. And we have forecast projected expenditures historically with DOT and prospectively with Commerce with the grants to local communities that fully utilizes the $180 million that was generated by all prior sales this fiscal year. So it's with the bond anticipation note program, we don't anticipate issuing additional obligations until such time as we have all the funds that are currently on hand expended. That requires a lot of administrative work on our side, not me personally, but in the accounting department, because of the inefficiencies of our accounting system as it points towards bond funds. But that's been our directive, and that's going to be our approach. And so we're going to minimize our footprint. As far as the historical program, we actually have earned more on the money that we've held than we're paying in interest expense because of that short position that we've had. So we had a TIC, or a net interest cost, on the first year of about 9 basis points, the second year just under 10, and the third year of 15 basis points. And so we're paying extraordinarily low rates. That's being reinvested in the short-term pool over in Treasury Division and exceeding those costs. So it hasn't been where if we would have taken those initial cash flows and issued $200 million of long-dated debt, we would have been earning 40 basis points and paying, even if it was 2.5% or 3%, we would have had a lot of negative carry on our construction fund. And so that's where we've been trying to manage and make sure that we don't just have money laying around in the bank unless we actually need to.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I were a rating agency following this conversation, the takeaway for the rating agency would be that these were anticipated from the previous issuance of bonds, and that this is a normal business procedure, and there's not new debt or new obligations that the state is on, only retooling past debt to make sure that it is earning or performing in a way that is most efficient for Alaska.
That would be a good way of describing it.
If you have a better way, please.
Oh, that's provided.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay,
go ahead, Mr. Mitchell, back on to your presentation.
So we've probably, we've bounced around a little bit. This describes some of what we've already talked about with the bond anticipation note program and the authorization from 2012 and the interest rates that we were able to achieve. One of the things I didn't describe is that we have been asking for and receiving appropriations for debt service on the bond anticipation notes that actually retire bonds, and so that from our perspective is a conservative way to approach it. We could just pay interest only, or we could say, oh, we're not going to pay anything today, we're going to kick it down the road, and rather than do that, we've tried to treat our, even though we have a short-term position, as if it were a long-term amortizing obligation, so that we don't wind up with our chart on the right, which is our GO bond outstanding debt service, and you can see it kind of stair steps down. And that's because historically we've issued level debt service, so 15, as short as 10-year, 15, or 20-year level debt service for general obligation bonds. And we have that one funny little maturity out in 2038, and that's because it's a qualified school construction bond, which is a special form of tax credit bond, wherein which you can see we don't pay any interest expense really between 2038 and 2034, and that's because the federal government gives us a reimbursement for our interest expense. That's why it's stuck out there as far into the future as possible. So this is just the outstanding debt. You can see our on the left, that little bar chart, it shows the outstanding debt at about $750 million and then diminishing steadily each year, where within about 10 years we've paid off the majority of our outstanding GO bonds. But don't forget that we have the 271 of authorization that we haven't issued yet, and this doesn't include the $150 million that we have outstanding in our bond anticipation note program. So that's going to bump these numbers up a little bit once it's incorporated into the graphs. And the same thing on the chart on the or on the graph on the right.
Mr. Mitchell, I would just like to assert that I personally am watching the debt situation of the state very closely, and any debt that we don't incur is a good thing. We know that we have obligations or opportunities that have already been approved. This administration seems to be trying to use debt in good ways, but in some ways, as an example, the pension obligation bond conversation, in ways that at least myself as an individual legislator doesn't support at this time. The case has not been made, but I understand the administration has the flexibility and is on the record not to use debt in that way at this time. But I'm concerned that we're reshuffling the cards, and debt is a huge component that is being utilized. Thank you,
Senator McKinnon. Go ahead, Mr. Mitchell.
So the next slide, page 4, is the authorized but unissued, and so that includes the $271 million of GO bonds that we already talked about, and an estimate of what the debt service might be on that. The Knick Arm Crossing project, which in 2014, $300 million of state-supported debt was authorized. They're working on being accepted by the TIFIA loan program, which is a federal transportation loan program, and if they are able to get that approval, then we'd move forward with this at that time. It has an estimated annual debt service of $25 million, and these bonds would be structured as state-supported but subordinate lien toll revenue bonds, and so to the extent toll revenue exceeded O&M and the TIFIA loan payment requirements, you could use it to pay down these bonds as well.
Senator McKinnon, just a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, I understand the 20-year debt. For a structure like Kinnick Arm Crossing that you would think would have 30, 50-year life on that big of a project, is there a reason that we choose 20 years and not, and I understand that increased length of time on debt causes increased cost to the overall project, but is there a reason that that we've set on 20 years versus another number?
It was in the fiscal note.
Thank you.
So I just looked at the 2014 fiscal note and put that information in here, and so that was the plan that was described to the legislature and proposed by the administration at the time. Ultimately, that term could be adjusted. Yes,
Mr. Chairman, if I just
go ahead.
Quick follow-up: would the bond committee be making that determination, or would the administration, or would you want direction from the legislature if that project were to move forward?
Through the chair, at this point, it's an approved authorization, and so the state bond committee would make that determination. If you wanted to have an influence on that, I'm sure you could let your views be known, or more forcefully, you could change the law and make it so it had to be the way that you viewed.
Mr. Chairman, my only comment would be for the State Bond Committee to consider the current situation and issue the length of term of the debt that benefits the state in the most advantageous way.
Go ahead, Mr. Mitchell.
And then we also have pension obligation bonds. There's an authorization for up to $5 billion to be issued. As we've already discussed, the administration has chosen to not just act on that authorization, but to ensure that the legislature agrees that that would be a reasonable path before proceeding. And then the school debt reimbursement program, we already talked about that. And I think that as far as the known or anticipated bond issues, the one that we didn't talk about is that the Matanuska, Sioux City, Borough, Goose Creek Correctional Facility lease revenue bonds. We refinanced a portion of those last year, the longer bonds. The market, the day we were pricing was, or trying to, we were selling those bonds for that refinancing, wasn't going our way. And we wound up not refinancing all the bonds because there was no interest in our debt in the kind of the belly, they call it, of the curve, the mid-dated maturities. And so we wound up just doing the longer dated maturities. We wound up having a pretty successful sale, 8.5% PV savings, which exceeds our targets by about twice what they are, and generated about $8.5 million PV savings. So it was a successful transaction, but we have an additional piece that with current rates, we might go back to the well and give that another shot. But have to rely on the borough to be able to proceed in that undertaking. It kind of dovetails into Senator McKinnon's comments of earlier this morning, where when we use conduits to issue our debt, because we pay 100% of the debt service on those bonds, Matsu is just a conduit, and but we don't have control. We have to go ask, and Matsu, I'm not saying anything bad about the relationship with the borough because it's been very good, but there could be a situation at the borough that wasn't so favorable, and we don't have any ability really to get our debt adjusted without them.
Senator Chickie.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Senator McKinnon brought up one example, but do you have this list in your mind of statutory guidance for our debt that you wish were different, that could use some improvement to bring down the cost of outstanding debt and debt that has not yet been issued in the future?
Through the chair, Senator Matucci, I think that generally the state's debt program operates pretty efficiently. We have a conservative bunch in the state of Alaska, and to the extent the various programs are able, P people are efficient within those programs. I think really if you could have like I said earlier, maybe an adjustment to the school debt reimbursement program so that it's not, so that we don't rely on sub-entities to issue debt in a fashion that we view to be most advantageous, and we just issue it ourselves. But otherwise, I'm not sure, like the Kinnick Arm Crossing, it's a subject to appropriation, subordinate lien, toll revenue structure. We want to be able to use toll revenues to pay those bonds to the extent they're sufficient. So you don't want to make that a GO of the state, because then it creates issues with being able to do that. Because there's federal highway money going into the project, and so you have limitations on how you could use toll revenue if it's not. So anyways, it's a structure that, even though it's maybe slightly less efficient than a GO, it makes sense. As an example, and there's examples, and with the subject to appropriation debt outstanding at this point, there's reasons why, given the timing. I mean, we had a bunch of prisoners outside the state in Arizona at the time, later in Colorado, that folks wanted to move back to Alaska, and it's very difficult to get voters to approve a prison project, and so that's something that lends itself to the legislature making a decision without going to the voters for that type of discrete standalone project. So it's a lesser credit quality, but it makes sense. So I don't, other than that one suggestion, don't have something I can point to.
Senator Bishop has to go to a meeting regarding his subcommittee, so thank you, Senator Bishop. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, you're
Mr.
missing
Mitchell.
The best slide.
Any other questions before we go to this slide?
I've heard talk. I've watched a couple committees on gavel to gavel on the budget and whatnot, and heard talk about the pension obligation bond issue that's been proposed. And there's, in my view, been, I think, some references to failures with pension obligation bonds, which aren't anything like what we're talking about here in the state of Alaska. So there are good ways to consider POBs, and which are pension obligation bonds, and bad ways to consider them. The bad ways that folks have entered the market or entered into this arena is that, first of all, interest rate is key. The lower you can drive your interest rate, statistically, given historical 20-year return averages, the lower you drive your interest rate, the higher your probability of success. And that was the whole basis of the bill being passed back in 2008. And back in 2008, we were talking about interest rates in the 6.5 handle. And right now, we're below 5, what we're talking about. And when you look, if you went back in time and pulled out, it was Brian Andrews at the time, had the analysis that he was presenting to committees. If you drove your interest rate below 5%, your probability of success based on historical 20-year average returns was near 100%. It's not 100% because it's the future. It's uncertain. But it's near 100%. And if you have a pension system, a pre-funded pension system that's relying on investment earnings, it's a reasonable thing to consider. Not that you're going to do it, but it's a reasonable thing to consider. And in particular, if you're not using the potential savings, because in some ways, for me, being a debt guy, it's easier to think about it as a refinancing. So the unfunded liability is being amortized, if you will, at an 8% rate. The actuarially assumed rate of return is 8% within the funds. So that's how they're amortizing the unfunded liability. And if we can refinance that at 5%, well, I just knocked 3% off what I'm going to pay, which is good. And that's, like in this particular slide, if you looked at the first column prior TERS, and this is a TERS example, the prior TERS obligation in the first column is $3.8 billion. And in the state payment after transaction column, which is blue, the total of the payments is $3.42 billion. So I just knocked $400 million off if my assumptions are correct. My assumptions if my experience, I should say, matches up with the actuarial assumptions. That's not to say that they are. It could be better. It could be worse. The probabilities, given historical returns, are that you're going to be at least neutral to better off, and it's, again, you know, 98% of the time in past performance, no indicator of future performance. And then in the charts on the right, what
can I get you to pause just for a second, Senator Dunleavy?
Just a quick question. Devin, when you started out, you seemed to indicate you would manage your home finances a little different than you would the state's. Is this a type of financing that you would take on in your home finance?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I guess it's a different situation, but the, in some ways it's like saying, would I borrow if I had a pension fund that what had been earning 8%, and I was relying on that to earn 8%, and I had an opportunity to borrow through my mortgage at 3.5% or 4%. Me personally, I'm not a sophisticated investor. I don't have a full-time investment staff reviewing my investments, and so I would be more reluctant to
probably
do that
not, is
individually.
What you're saying.
As an entity, well, yeah, if that's probably your question.
Just a quick comment. It's not you, but we've sat here for 3 years, and some of us were beat over the head that oil would be $160 a barrel today. There's been some wildly off-the-mark predictions and assessments made by experts. But anyway, thank you for the answering the question.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And so the other thing that folks have done where they've gone sideways on these types of transactions is they assume that so that delta between the state payments after transactions after transaction and the prior TERS obligation, that all of that is actually going to happen, and they take the benefit in year one or year two. So they pay it forward, if you will. And that's not what we've been talking about at all. We've been talking about the fact that the actuarially required payments ascend fairly steeply into the future, and trying to diminish that level of increase. So in essence, back-end loading the savings, meaning that we're not trying to, the example people like to use is have our children pay for our obligations. We're trying to avoid having our children pay for our obligations by doing this, because you actually pay slightly more in 18, 19, and 20 than you otherwise would. Then you are paying less after that if the 8% rate of return over the long term is in fact realized. And out in that 2039 range, you're looking at that reduction of $45 million, which isn't taking advantage of something for today. It's putting in place a plan that results in a greater ability to have budget stability. And that's probably enough on POBs. So,
any of these slides that you don't feel are 100% necessary for your presentation, just breeze through them. Sometimes people get dialed in; they think they have to go through every slide and every point. Yeah.
Yep. So this slide's halfway important. It's just that we have these metrics. So, kind of like when you buy a house, they want your house payment to be less than 28% of your gross income. Well, we've got this 5% or 8% of unrestricted revenue that we use for debt service. So we try to limit unrestricted or general obligation bonds to no more than 5% of unrestricted revenue, or total state-supported debt to no more than 8% of unrestricted revenue. And you can see that with existing in red, yellow being authorized, that on the GO side we have a little bit of capacity. It's about $175 million. on the right-hand side with the 8% metric. It's really zero, even though out there in year 2024 and 2025, you could say that you could issue $225 million.
Go ahead, Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, what basis did you use? Did you use FY15 actuals, FY16 new revenue dollars for this slide, or projected revenues for FY17?
This is the fall revenue sources book for projections for 16 and throughout. So it doesn't, if there were a modification to how the state recognizes revenue, which is one of the points in the revenue sources book this year, for the first time we have a table called available, what is it called, state appropriatable revenue, which gives you, I think, or at least in my view, it's something we've been pounding the table on about with rating analysts for quite a while, that we have these categories of money within the state where we call it restricted. It's not restricted at all. The legislature could spend that money. They just don't. They put it into savings because that's what we've always done. It doesn't mean that they can't change. It just means that they've chosen not to and haven't been forced to at this point. And so if you come up with a different definition of what revenue is, it's going to change this model, and it's also going to result in a change in, I think, our approach a little bit. We're going to have to rethink it a little bit.
Questions from committee members? Please continue.
These slides, or that slide, is, I think, self-evident. It's the ratings of the state, and a couple of quotes that folks have supplied on the state referencing the strengths that we have. I think one of the key strengths that we've had is the size of our reserves. That's gotten us over the hump with both Moody's and S&P historically to get out of the AA plus category into the AAA category based on their scoring criteria.
Mr. Mitchell, on that slide, do any other rating agencies point to the closed pension plan as a plus inside of their view of the state?
Madam Chair, they all reference that it, or have referenced it at one point or another. The fact that we have dealt with our pension plans and closed the systems to the defined benefit structure, that has been a positive discussion with them.
And for those listening, that's because at least we know the liability. It's not a statement about good, bad, or otherwise. It's a statement from a financial perspective that you understand your liability and you're working towards closing that liability or eliminating it. Is that fair?
Yes.
Thank you.
So this is a timeline of since December 13 through today of the price of oil. So you can see we were AAA stable outlook there back when the price of oil was $105 a barrel. There were some contacts with rating analysts back in that time frame as well. We sold debt in September of 14 for the ANTHC building, and so we had a contact there. Again, there's a couple of omissions on this as far as contacts go, but generally it's intended to let the committee know that we've been very active with our relationship with the rating analysts and the rating agencies since the price of oil diminished and the negative outlook from Moody's was released in December of 2014. And you can see the various transactions and touches that we had with folks between there and here. And then I threw this in there. This was provided to me by one of the underwriting firms that follows the state, RBC Capital, where they went through the scorecards for Moody's and Standard and Poor's. And so I don't know if you guys, if I were going to skip some slides, it would be these. I think these are good informational slides. but they're not necessarily, they're more observations than anything. So you can see how Moody's, they try to make everybody fit into the same box, which is very difficult with the state of Alaska because we don't fit into the boxes very well. But generally, they come up with scores that that 1 to 1.7 range or AAA and 1.7, 2.7, lower, and so on and so forth, with economy, governance, finance, and debt being the weighted categories. And you can see how RBC, they used a guy, Dan Heimowitz, who used to work at Standard & Poor's and now is their full-time debt guy or their full-time credit analysis guy, which most of the firms have somebody like that that they use to provide information to issuers. So you can see how they evaluated our economy, governance, finance, and debt. And then you can see S&P has a similar type system where they rank, they have one more category, what, budgetary performance. And again, you can see how they went through, this is Dan's view of how they went through and weighted the state of Alaska. And then Fitch doesn't use a scorecard, they use a more general approach. They do evaluate the same factors, but just don't have that scorecard concept embedded into their process.
Mr. Mitchell, I went online after we received the downgrade from Standard & Poor's to look for that scorecard and did find, under Standard & Poor's, this concept of economy, governance, finance, and debt. And then at the criteria, which I appreciate you providing Alaskans today. And I'm wondering if the state has a scorecard, because this is certainly the issue that the Finance Committee in the Senate is looking at. And we've talked about the lens that we would use with any bills that came before our body, that we would see how it affected the economy, and we would measure that by how our individual businesses affected, how are individuals affected by any of the proposals from the governor or from another legislature. The governance, the finances, we understand the debt, but I would ask you to work with us to develop our own scorecard based on a mix of what we see from the three rating agencies in large categories, and then help Alaskans focus on why these are important for the Senate to be looking at. And so, as an example, our committees talked about unemployment rate and the U.S. unemployment rate being higher than the national average, and that's an indicator that we'll watch. Another indicator that the rating agencies are watching is what is the standard income. Another that the rating agencies and the Senate Finance Committee will be watching is the migration of workers out of the state. So if the population is increasing, then we can see that as a positive for the economy, and that's how the world looks at Alaska. And so I look forward to working with you after this committee to actually standardize that, because we've been trying to articulate that to Alaskans through a variety of messages that have come from every one of our committee members. And I'd like to formalize it so that the people of Alaska understand the lens at which the Senate Finance Committee is looking at moving forward. Senator Machicki.
Looking at the Moody's scorecard, can you explain under financial best practices, obviously that score is not looked at positively, but it says state does not use a binding consensus revenue estimating process. Can you explain that and let me know your thoughts on whether that's something we should be striving toward? I assume it has to do with a degree of relative accuracy on estimating revenues.
Mm-hmm. Or spending.
Through the chair, I said it earlier that Alaska doesn't always fit into the boxes very well, and that might be a good example that how we've historically classified revenue. You look at unrestricted general fund revenue for the last 20 years, and there's a ton of volatility But if you look at that category of revenue available for appropriation, you have a lot better stability. And so the volatile unrestricted general fund revenue category, we backfill with the statutory budget reserve more recently, or the CBRF since the early 90s. And the revenue that's gone into those funds, oftentimes, so we've had what we call the deficit spending year, and at the same time, we put more money into the CBR than we pulled out. So we actually didn't have, and so when we're talking about what's available for appropriation and calling revenue and saying, okay, well, we've got this much unrestricted revenue and that's going to be our cap, we have a very difficult time trying to conform to that because we can't because of how we classify revenue.
Senator Machicki.
In the last several years, I mean, we do issue a revenue forecast twice a year. But I assume the binding consensus means something we've suffered from, and that is overestimating the price of oil on a fairly regular basis. Does that mean that our pool is too small on evaluating the probable price atmosphere or something else?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I don't think it relates. Personally, I don't think it relates to that angle. I think it's more that if the legislature said, here's how much money there is based on the forecast, and that's all that you can spend, then it would be a binding forecast. But because the forecast says, here's what's available, and we say, well, we'll spend that, and if it's not enough, we'll draw from the CBR, then it's not a binding forecast. They also at times have indicated, and Jerry's still back there, he'll probably can hit me, but that the legislature being a required checkoff for the revenue sources book rather than it just being the administration that prepares the revenue sources book could be a positive step.
Any other questions? Senator Dunleavy?
The rating agency's rate, they don't set the rates.
No.
The rates are negotiable.
Oh. Through the chair, I misunderstood what you meant by rate. I thought you meant like interest rate. They don't set interest rates. They do set your credit rating, yes.
And then when the credit rating is set by them, the actual interest on the final debt that you're selling, is that negotiable between the state and the institutions that would be issuing that debt, or is it not? Is it set? It's set and that's it.
Through the chair, it's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I'm on the right avenue, but so when we sell debt, of course, we go out and we get a credit rating on that debt from the state of Alaska, gets it from Fitch, Moody's, and S&P. That rating is then incorporated into our disclosure document, and there's a report that's available to potential investors, available from those rating agencies. The investors themselves then make a decision about credit quality that's independent of the rating analysts. And so your debt might be rated AA and price like a single A credit of another entity, or vice versa. And so there's other variables that go into the mix as well when you're trying to establish interest rate. In Alaska, we don't have an income tax, and we have a small population, so even if we did have an income tax, it doesn't have the type of effect that a New York City tax plus a New York State tax, all being exempted from income or having to pay income tax, the interest income on the bonds being exempt from those taxes in addition to federal tax, makes them automatically a more advantageous investment for those people, and there's a lot of them, and they have a lot of disposable income, and so their bonds are going to price at a better rate than our bonds because of that. And so there's these these variables that you have to kind of pull apart and say, well, there's always a story to how the interest rate is set, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah, thanks.
So?
Yes.
You done? Okay.
I'm good.
All righty. Any other questions or comments? Senator Bishop, you came back just as we were wrapping up. Did you have any closing questions, areas of curiosity, a comment? Senator McKinnon?
Mr. Chairman, it was shown that at this point in time, with the outstanding obligations that we currently have in anticipation of some of the larger debt that has already been approved, if we take all of the debt that's already been approved that could go to bond, what's our current debt capacity?
Through the chair, it depends. I mean, the metrics that we've established are what we consider to be best practices. That doesn't limit an issuer from abiding to those best practices. All you have to, I mean, Puerto Rico is maybe the best example of an entity that has used debt to excess. I mean, they have more debt outstanding than the state of New York. And they're paying, I don't know if they're paying the price, but certainly the investors that bought the bonds are paying the price at this point. So it's a best practice. If there's a project or a priority that needs to be funded, you have to weigh that in your analysis. You go, well, if I've got a priority that needs to be funded and this is a means of accomplishing that priority and it results in us being in the double A category, that's just a choice. That's, I mean, why have a shiny tool you never take off the shelf?
So you're sitting in your office and the governor calls up and says, hey, Mitchell, how much capacity we got? I want to do some bonding. What's the answer you give him?
The same one I just gave you.
Come on. There's a number. There's got to be a general number that you throw around.
Well, for purposes of the fall forecast and our debt affordability analysis and the metrics we have on record, it would be, you know, 175 to 225 million.
Okay.
And that's what we've historically used as a metric.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, you and I have talked. I think that was a great answer. But the debt affordability analysis, January 2016, beginning on page 3 of 20, the state has an estimated capacity to issue up to $175 million of general bonds without impacting its current credit rating. However, the potential issuance, this is already approved, and that's why I couched the question how I asked. I was very careful how I asked you that. However, the potential impact of the Connect Arm Crossing bonds that were authorized already, which is why I use the word authorized, results in the state exceeding the target debt limit for this category of borrowing for the next 10 years. So if we stay within our own policy, it would be fair for this committee to consider that we have zero bond debt capacity based on what has already been authorized.
Through the chair, that's accurate. I'm sure wrote that. In my mind, it's a message of caution. I was thinking about it today, I handicap the Kinnick Arm Crossing project a little bit. They have some hurdles to get across still before the project is going to be actually implemented. And so I think we'll know a lot more in the next. I mean, they had rating analysts coming to Anchorage this week to look at the project site and meet with the project team. So in the next couple months, 6 months, I'm sure we'll know a lot more about that project. But you're right.
Senator Machicki.
A couple questions, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, so, you know, folks back home, we talk about our rating and why it's an issue, but we're also talking about severe cuts, possible taxes, impacts to the PFD, and we use the rating as one of the reasons we have to get control of our fiscal gap. As the debt manager, can you please explain in layman's terms to Alaskans why we care?
Through the chair, Representative Michicki. So we actually sold some bonds 2 weeks ago for folks back home in Kenai through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, which the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank rating is linked to the state's rating. And to the extent that rating was lower, those bonds would be more expensive for the residents to pay. That was for the health clinic there. We're talking to the Fairbanks North Star Borough about doing some school bonds that that if the state's rating goes down, those are going to be more expensive to issue. And so it's important to keep costs low to maintain as high a credit rating as is possible, just like as an individual, bringing it back to that. If what would you do on an individual basis? You would try to keep your credit score as high as possible, so when you go to the bank, they take that into consideration. If it means a half a percent off your loan rate because you got a higher score, well, that does nothing but benefit you.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So along those same lines, in your opinion, what would be the most important components of our fiscal gap that would require some progress to stop the rating slide?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, there needs to be, in my view, based on the interactions, a recognition of the true revenue generation that's available at the state of Alaska. That, as I said earlier, there's, if you looked back at FY14, the CAFR showed that we had a deficit, but our net position went up by $6 billion. We had a deficit of over $1 billion, but our net position went up by six because we don't recognize revenue. We don't recognize certain categories of revenue, and the largest one is the permanent fund. Has statutory net earnings every year. We don't recognize those as earnings, even though they are revenues of the state of Alaska. We call them restricted. People don't understand that. And so anyways, there needs to be some step to recognize that revenues are available to the state. You can alternatively come up with a plan to reduce spending in a significant fashion, but significant fashion is something that I don't think is achievable in the current environment we're in.
Last question.
Senator Michicki?
So this one's out there, and I admit it, okay? But I want you to, if you can, explain to me why this is not something that anyone would ever want to consider. Could you ever consider a more negative rating as incentive or a tool to control the use of increasing debt during very difficult times?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
So,
I got it.
So with some of the moves we have to make in defense of our credit rating, if things get really tough, debt may look more attractive. Would you ever consider allowing a rating to become more negative to sort of force responsible management without the use of debt?
That's outside my bailiwick.
Good answer.
I focus on debt, so I would focus on just doing that aspect, doing that portion.
Just tell the truth.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have I got a question and then a comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Can you refresh my memory on Garvey bonds and how those instruments are applied and how they are paid for?
So, through the chair, we issued what were Garvey bonds, in a sense, back in 2003. There, we had to struggle with. So a Garvey bond in some states can be a revenue pledge with a motor fuel tax back that then you anticipate using federal highway funds of the future to pay for those obligations along with the state match requirement. In Alaska's case, because we can't dedicate revenue, we kind of struggled with how do we get there, because we can't pledge either those future federal revenues or other revenue. And so we did a GO. The general obligation bond was repaid, and it was, what, the Accelerated Transportation Act? We had two series. So in that instance, we issued general obligation bonds of the state, there, which the beauty of that was then the proceeds that we generated, the investment earnings on those proceeds, we actually used those investment earnings as the state's match. So our UGF outlay was ultimately zero because we just used investment earnings, and then we used federal highway funds to pay all of the debt service on those obligations.
Thank you for refreshing my memory, because that's the way I understood it as well. So with that being said, you know, yesterday I talked about there's spending, in my opinion, for services, and there's spending for investment with return on investment that's good debt. And, you know, as we're going forward and here in Alaska, we have an industry that's, you know, 14,000 plus construction workers in this state, and it's no secret I made a living building roads and highways and civil construction projects, and as we're looking at building a gas line, you know, I want to make sure we maintain keep our economy chugging along, albeit it might be a little slower here for a little while, but also to preserve our workforce. It's written, it's public information. You know, Steve Bott from ExxonMobil said one of the biggest challenges to an AKLNG project is having the skilled craft labor to execute the project. They're very concerned about that. That's their words. And I and mine too, you know, right? I've been sitting where you're at and looking at this body in a different direction, looking up there at the chairman defending me. What we're going to do for workforce development in the state. So with that being said, I just want all of us to keep an open mind on construction infrastructure projects going forward and or the use of bonds at some point in time to keep a healthy workforce here as we bridge this gap in Alaska.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Dunleavy?
Just real quick, these are the same rating agencies that were rating bonds during the 07-08 meltdown, correct?
Through the chair, yes.
And, of course, there were some very interesting instruments and loans that were happening at that time. Just a comment, I think yesterday in the paper we hit a milestone, $18 trillion in debt. We've passed the $18 trillion debt mark. To get out of that, the taxpayers paid almost $3 trillion. The people of the country paid almost $3 trillion to bail out those outfits. And you mentioned Puerto Rico. I would suggest people really research Puerto Rico, because folks are fleeing there en masse. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is optimism is a good thing. It's a positive thing. But sometimes it shouldn't override historical realities. And we just need to be careful as we go there. You've got Puerto Rico, you have several cities down south. You had the country, the world actually, that was on the brink for some time. And some would say it's never really worked out some of those issues, some of those toxic derivatives. And basically it was debt, large amounts of debt. And that's the only caution I would give to folks of Alaska is there's never a free ride. Somebody pays for this. I know people think that it just comes in an envelope, a check, but somebody pays for this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's Moody's or Standard & Poor's, but they put out a paper that was, in my opinion, basically a policy position paper, and they were hinting strongly that if we tap into personal taxes and if we tap into the permanent fund, our ratings would go up. But it's really a cost-shifting issue. We've lost $3 billion to $4 billion in wealth because oil prices have collapsed. So now we're seeking out other potential revenue measures. We're cost-shifting to federal funds. We're cost-shifting potentially to debt. We're cost-shifting potentially to personal income taxes, and we're cost-shifting potentially to the permanent fund. We're running in front of the problem internationally, nationally. Puerto Rico is almost getting steamrolled by the problem, but there's going to be a lot of hard questions, at least from some of us, as to how do we avoid some of these issues that really haven't gone away. They're still there, and we don't know how they're going to manifest themselves, and I'm just concerned that Alaska is not going to go down the same trail, because sometimes there's just no easy fix to some of these things. Sometimes it really just comes down to tightening your belt and dealing with some discomfort for a while to get out of it until we create more wealth. That's my comment.
Thank you. I had a smile on my face for a completely different reason. I wasn't laughing at you, Senator Tubman. I just saw the return of the former commissioner as he walked out of my office. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Appreciate your presentation. No finance tomorrow, and probably the next meeting will be on Tuesday with the Permanent Fund Corporation presentation. I'm going to go ahead and chair that. Okay. And questions, comments? What do we got? Anything, Senator McKinnon?
So the general public knows, we're continuing to pursue Medicaid, and so we're trying to push that up. So just because full finance isn't meeting, the subcommittee on the Medicaid reform is continuing to meet, and we'll even ramp up that schedule, or we hope to ramp up that schedule even further next week.
We've already had two meetings on that, and yesterday was the presentation by the Menges committee or group. Yeah. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We are adjourned.